I am here with Dr. Henry Emmons, who is a psychiatrist who specialized in integrative mental health. He is the author of three books, The Chemistry of Joy, The Chemistry of Calm, and The Chemistry of Joy Workbook, and is currently working on a book using new neuroscience discoveries to promote healthy aging. We are very excited to have him with us here today, and welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Emmons.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So I would like to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your current role today.
Sure. So I consider myself an integrative psychiatrist. I have a number of different places where I practice. I do some consulting to a number of colleges in the area. I do a lot of speaking and teaching workshops and so forth. And then I still do some writing. But I consider my main work right now to be still clinical. I have a clinical private practice in Minneapolis, and I see mostly adults, a few late teens, and I try to specialize in offering more integrative therapies. And so people come to me for a variety of reasons, but often it is to get a second opinion from a more holistically oriented psychiatrist.
So when we think about integrative mental health, and we talk about integrative mental health, what does that mean to you?
I often explain integrative mental health as advanced common sense. The only reason I can say advanced is because I try to base everything that I do on good science, and I think that the science can get fairly sophisticated and sometimes complex, but the interventions, I think, can be quite simple and elegant. And to me, practicing in an integrative way is truly common sense, because it is not excluding anything that would be potentially helpful to the patient. It's trying to bring everything to bear, especially things that patients can learn to do for themselves, that they can take with them, the tools or a toolbox that they can create that really makes a difference in their long-term outcome.
So why do you think we need to use a special term for integrative mental health?
That is a good question, and I imagine there'll be a day where we may not need to use a special term, where practicing in this integrative way is just the way things are done.
Yeah.
But I think in the meantime, it is important, because it's distinguishing what we do as compared to treatment as usual. And it is still the case that, you know, the vast majority, I don't know the percentage, but I'm sure it's well over 90%, is still traditional, you know, medical model treatment as usual. And, you know, in my view, that kind of treatment is not a bad thing. It's something that should be incorporated into an integrative practice. Mm-hmm. It's just that if you practice in that way alone, I think you're limiting yourself more than you need to, and more than that your patients need to be limited.
So talking about integrative mental health and how that is a different way of kind of traditionally doing it, how did you come into seeing things that way? What was your journey?
Well, I have been a psychiatrist now for 25 years, hard to believe, but I have been at this that long. And, you know, back in those early days of practice, and even before that when I was in training, there was no such term as integrative mental health. Mm-hmm. The term that might have been used back then would have been holistic medicine or holistic practice. And, you know, we've gone through several iterations. But when I look back at my own journey, I see that the way I practice now, the seeds were there absolutely from the beginning. It's not anything foreign or really that unusual for me. It's the way I've always thought. Mm-hmm. And the way I've always tried to practice, it's just that we are now getting, I think, a lot more sophisticated, and it's become much more widely accepted that this is really a legitimate way of practice. But, I remember very clearly when I was in college, maybe even before that, being really interested in nutrition as a means of improving people's health and well-being, and some nutritional or holistic therapies, alternative therapies, and also in fitness. And it wasn't until later that I really learned and began to incorporate mindfulness. But the basics of lifestyle medicine were really ingrained in me from the beginning. And then through my medical training, it became very hard to hold on to that.
Yeah.
There's just at that time even, there was so much other information that we had to learn, and there was precious little mention in the curriculum even about good nutrition, or you know, certainly nothing at that time about any kind of nutritional therapies or so forth. So for me, when I was a medical student, I really had to work at finding how to grow in my knowledge and interest in those areas. And so I had some resources that still exist in some form or other. At that time, there was a organization called the American Medical Student Association, which had a very active branch that they called, I think, the American Holistic Medical Student Group. And so it was, there was a already some interest around the nation, but it was just a very small percentage of medical students. But there were people, even then, the American Holistic Medical Association was very active. And I had an opportunity when I was just had finished my first year of medical school. I spent that summer first attending a conference of the American Holistic Medical Association. So it was one of their, I think it was their third or fourth national conference. And they had a lot of early pioneers that were part of that group. And I was blown away by the depth of scientific knowledge of some of the presenters, especially around what we now call nutraceuticals. So that was just really interesting to me. And then I spent the rest of the summer living and working with a physician who many people know named Norm Shealy. And Dr. Shealy, he's now in his 80s and extremely vibrant and healthy and has an active practice. But he is truly one of the pioneers of holistic medicine in this country. And he had a practice at that time that was mostly geared towards people with chronic pain. Okay. People would come to his clinic in Springfield, Missouri. They would spend at least a week, sometimes 2 weeks, learning a lot about diet and a little bit about fitness or movement, and then learning these practices that they called autogenic training, where it was kind of an early mind-body skills training. They would basically learn to calm their mind and to focus their attention on some aspect of their physiology. So they'd often just use a temperature probe, kind of an early simple biofeedback.
Sure. Okay.
But it was very effective, and I was very impressed with how much better people got simply by learning how to do something with their body in a different way.
Yeah.
And so I just continued over the years of at least my medical school training to try and expose myself as much as I could to some of the thinkers and leaders. And then I chose to go into psychiatry because I thought that might really be an avenue for me to incorporate a lot of my interests. I thought, you know, this would be a great way to really spend time with patients, get to know them well, be able to see them as a whole person, be able to incorporate some of my interest in spirituality and spiritual practices. And so I was drawn to psychiatry. And then I very quickly realized that psychiatrists didn't practice that way anymore. I think they used to.
Yeah.
More so, maybe back in the 50s and 60s. And by the time I was in my training in the mid to late 1980s, it was all biological psychiatry. So I was well trained in that. I did train out east, so I got some good psychotherapy training still. But I really had to look hard to find the other things I was interested in.
So psychotherapy isn't necessarily or wasn't necessarily a part of every residency program you
In theory, it was part of every resident. It was a requirement.
Sure.
But when you really start to look around, even then, it was clear that it was, some places it was just lip service.
Sure.
and very, very little actual training in psychotherapy.
Sure.
So I intentionally went to the either coast had good training. I went to the East Coast because the Midwest was really biologically oriented. Mm-hmm. And I just knew that wasn't all that I wanted.
Yeah.
So I found that a pretty good balance. In upstate New York, Rochester, New York, they had done a lot of the early work in psychoneuroimmunology and what became known as the biopsychosocial model. A lot of that came out of that residency program before my time. And by the time I got there, the tradition was still there, but it was still mostly biological. Mm-hmm. So I was good, well trained in that, and I feel like I those are important skills, and I'm competent in it. But when I moved back to Minneapolis then, and I took a job with Health Partners, which is a big HMO here, most people know of it. The role of the psychiatrist is pretty narrowly defined, and it's basically crisis management and medication management. I became very good at that. I did that for 5 years. I saw a lot of people, became very good at it, but it was clear to me from the beginning that that wasn't going to be enough for me, to satisfy my interest as a psychiatrist and as a professional. So after probably 3 years of that, I watched a TV show that influenced a lot of people in healthcare called Healing in the Mind.
Okay.
It was a Bill Moyers special, and it featured the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who people now know about. But at that time, before the show came out, hardly anybody knew of him. And he was a mindfulness teacher. He taught mindfulness-based stress reduction, a program that he designed, and he taught it in a university healthcare center.
Yeah.
So it had some legitimacy, and there was some research that was starting, and he was a fabulous speaker and teacher. And so, I immediately, after watching that show, I signed up to train with him, and that was 1992. So I did a mindfulness-based stress reduction training, and then for the next 20 years, I've taught MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, as a means of trying to help people with mental health problems.
Yeah.
So I was immediately able to start offering those groups within the HMO. Mm-hmm. I just called it group therapy. After just a year or two more at Health Partners, I decided to move on. And since then, it's for me, it's been a continual journey of trying to spend more of my time and energy doing the things that I really am interested in and less doing the things I'm really not interested in. And so, I've had to prune things here and there and eventually just have ended up with my own practice, a private practice. After being in a number of other large organizations. And I found that the organizational medicine has some really good things about it and then also some limitations that finally, for me, I decided to do more of a private practice kind of approach. But I've had a chance to do some writing in the context of all this. Before that, I had an opportunity to do a Bush Fellowship, which allowed me to really delve into the nutrition and mindfulness and some of the natural therapies
more deeply.
Through
what institution was that?
The Bush Fellowship at the time, this would have been, I think, 1998 or 9, it was really a sabbatical program.
Okay.
And so you did not have to go to an institution. You could organize it on your own. And that's what I did. So I did a lot of self-teaching, a lot of reading. Went to a number of trainings and workshops, including the mind-body skills training with Jim Gordon.
Sure.
So I did that at probably in 1998 and 1999. And then I also did more deep training with the mindfulness practices. And then I started to design my own programs after that. And after writing The Chemistry of Joy, I had an opportunity to create a program called Resilience Training that really incorporates all of those things. It was a way of bringing together nutritional therapies, really focusing on a healthy diet and being able to individualize that diet for each patient, being able to take a look at all the medications people were taking and often try to simplify or reduce some of the side effect burden, try to get the meds working better with nutraceuticals if possible. And then we also had a fitness center, so people had a chance to get a really good individualized fitness assessment. And creating those programs, those lifestyle aspects of the program in a really individualized way, and then offering the mindfulness training in a group setting. And that program is more geared towards using mindfulness to help with mood and emotional reactivity and the thought, how the thoughts contribute to mood problems. So it's a little different than the MBSR approach, but it has a lot of similar roots.
You mentioned resiliency earlier.
Mm-hmm.
How do you kind of see resiliency and the concept of resiliency coming into integrated mental health, and how are those things connected?
Right. I have really come to see resilience as a central aspect to what keeps people healthy and afloat. And my notion, that I think this comes out of my mindfulness background, but I see people as fundamentally being healthy and having a state of well-being as their nature, mm-hmm. rather than being flawed or diseased or something fundamentally wrong as their nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is a really important precept of mindfulness. Look, what's right rather than what's wrong is the kind of the focus.
Yeah.
And so I've come to see resilience really as the natural state of affairs for human beings. We all have it. We're all born with it. And it's that essence or quality that allows us to be able to face whatever is going on in our lives, to adapt, to keep bouncing back if we do get knocked down, and everybody gets knocked down from time to time. But to be able to sustain an overall sense of well-being, even joyfulness at times. And then I do believe in the power of genetics, and people have different capacities in that regard. So I think some people have a lot greater capacity for resilience than others. But anybody, no matter what degree of natural resilience they have, can strengthen it and can fill up their tank, so to speak. So a lot of my work now is really geared towards that, trying to understand what is it that is depleting or eroding that person's resilience, and what can we do to stop that erosion, and then also what needs to happen in order to build the person's reserves back up again.
So with some of these different modalities you've been talking about, and with kind of a more holistic approach, you think of it in terms of using these different things or resources or approaches to build up a person's resilience.
Yes, exactly. And I think if it's not that people have to do this perfectly.
Yeah.
And that sometimes catches people up. They get overwhelmed with all of the advice and suggestions and whatnot. And some people feel like if they can't do it, 100%, that it's not worth doing at all. And I don't believe that. I think if people can just make good choices for themselves most of the time, just even 51% of the time, they're moving in that direction of health. And so we try to find what is the key for each individual person. Because for some, it really is diet. I think for a lot of mental health problems, it is perpetuated by an issue with their diet that is affecting their brain. And so sometimes just getting that right will restore a normal resilience. And for other people, they have to do other things. They have to add some nutritional supports or sometimes medication as a support. And of course, therapy can be a really useful tool as well. But I am continually struck with how helpful it is for people to learn some simple mindfulness skills, some way of relating to their thoughts and their emotions differently than happens when they are just kind of unconsciously buffered by all of the goings on around them.
You mentioned earlier that you were in a more traditional setting in the beginning, and there were certain things there that fit well for you and other things that didn't. Can you talk a little bit about what was it that didn't fit as well for you in that setting?
Sure. One thing I want to say that I thought was really helpful and important for me, especially early in my career, was being part of a group.
Yeah.
And at Health Partners, especially as I look back on it, we had a wonderful group of mental health providers. So we had, great psychiatrists, really good therapists, and a lot of variety. We had some acupuncturists even back in those early days. And it was a really, really nice opportunity to collaborate and work with a group. The thing that becomes a limiting factor for so many people in traditional healthcare settings is that everybody gets so busy and so driven by production, the need to see a lot of patients in a short period of time, that you even though you have a great group of people around you, you often have very little time to collaborate and or even to talk about what's going on. And so people often get stuck in their silos, their individual way of seeing things and practicing, and it's a real missed opportunity oftentimes. And so for me, that was one of the limiting factors. I mentioned earlier that the role of a psychiatrist has become so narrow and I think so kind of impoverished as a way of working and looking at people that to me, it just was unsustainable. I could not see myself doing that for an entire career. So I tried for a while. I tried to bring things into it like the mindfulness groups. And, you know, I just found that the balance wasn't there for me. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that is true for a lot of people. I've worked with a lot of clinicians over the years in various settings, and I think that's a very common experience. Feeling like you love the work that you came in to do, and I don't think people would even have to do integrative medicine to really feel good about their work. If they could really feel like they were connecting with their patients, like they had the time and the presence of mind and the openness of heart or spirit. And I think people really have those intentions and then they can't do it because they're so driven and harried and busy. And there's so much of their time now is spent doing paperwork and other things that the human connections that are so vital and crucial, people have a harder time finding those.
Going from that tradition a little bit and having to carve out your own path in some ways to be able to have a career that's nurturing for you, has there been any pushback from your colleagues or from establishment entities?
You know, surprisingly little, I would say. I think that maybe in the early days there was a little bit of pushback. I remember when I was in the first few years of teaching mindfulness classes, I would often give talks to physician groups and other health professionals to try to interest them in referring patients. And I think there was sometimes a great deal of skepticism. And there was occasionally that was verbalized. Other times it was sort of nonverbal, but it was there. And yet, you know, you look now at the landscape of healthcare and mindfulness is everywhere. It is, I think, very well respected. I think there's very few people anymore who hold a degree of skepticism because there's so much good research that shows, you know, what it's helpful for. It helps so many different things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I still think that there's quite a bit of controversy in healthcare about nutraceuticals, you know, vitamins and supplements. And I think that that sometimes that controversy kind of clouds some of the potential benefits people can get from that. But I actually get very little pushback. I think that, you know, there's so many physicians and other healthcare professionals now that are really looking to do things a different way that there's just a tremendous amount of openness towards these integrative models.
Now, there's often a certain dualism that seems to become predominant when we sometimes think about holistic approaches or integrative things, integrative therapies and integrative mental health included, where there's an either or. People on one side don't want to do the medications. So, you know, if you're holistic, then you're holistic. But holistic seems to mean no medications.
Yep.
And then if you're on the medication side, everything on the other side is, you know, so there becomes this divide. What is your experience kind of in both bridging that gap, but also resisting people wanting to pigeonhole you on either side or categorize you in a way that's not helpful?
That's a great question. Honestly, there was a time kind of early in my transition from traditional healthcare settings where I was pretty sure I wanted to be done with medication.
Right.
I'd had enough of it. I saw its limitations. I just was not interested. I wanted to become more of a naturopathic psychiatrist.
Sure.
And I really thought that was the direction I was going to go. And it wasn't very long into that attempt before I realized that it made no sense really to do that, because I think that there is a role for medication. I think that there are people who, because of the degree of their illness or you know, a whole variety of factors that they do need to do some kind, get some kind of support from medications. And I realized it made no sense to completely eliminate an entire treatment option. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that I have really worked hard to do a good job of bridging the different worlds. And in my view, this is just my own way of approaching this now. I don't experience this as dualistic at all.
Right.
I don't experience there being a big difference between the mind and the body. I think that they're just part of the same entity, the same, you know, human being. And I think that however we approach it, we should do it with great care and caution. And so my big concern now about medications and kind of the traditional forms of treatment is that they're overused, they're overprescribed at too high of a doses, they're causing, you know, a number of problems that don't get recognized as problems from the medications. I just don't think we're using meds very wisely. Mm. But, you know, that doesn't mean we shouldn't ever use them. And the same thing, I think, could be said for the more integrative or holistic therapies. They definitely have their role. I consider them to be safer on the whole. I don't think the risk is as great. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it's always the best choice or the first choice either.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that it makes a great deal of common sense. That's why I say this is advanced common sense, to bridge these different areas and to offer as many options for care as possible for patients. Because once you get into this work very long at all, you realize that not everybody gets better with just a single intervention.
Right.
So a lot of people who don't, and you've got to have more to offer them.
Where do you see the role of integrative mental health when it comes to severe and persistent mental illness, or SPMI?
That is a hard question to answer, and partly because I don't do a lot of that work myself. I certainly have in the past. I've seen a lot of people with severe mental illness, but it's never been a real clinical focus for me.
Sure.
And I don't think that it's realistic to assume that people with really severe mental illness can be treated successfully with only holistic therapies.
Yes.
I think that there is a place for meds there. But my thought is that there is so much driving serious and persistent mental illness that is not getting addressed at all.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the health of the brain and the way it's influenced, especially by diet, nutrition, inflammation. You know, so I think that if we could find some gentler ways to calm down the storm in the brain, then I think people could get by with a lot less medication and a lot less burden of side effects.
Yeah.
So I think that things can be done to help meds work more effectively, be able to reduce their doses, help people feel a lot better because they don't have all those side effects to contend with. And I think that's where, you know, the natural therapies can have a really important role. I do treat a lot of people with bipolar illness, which, you know, can become a serious and persistent mental illness. And I think there is a lot that can be done with integrative therapies.
How do you kind of see the state of integrative mental health now when you think about the current kind of situation, how things are? Where do you think we are?
You know, I think that we as a healthcare world are poised for this to really take off.
Yeah.
I think it actually has already started.
Yeah.
The wave has started probably a few years ago, but it is building, you know, with a real crescendo.
Yeah.
You know, mindfulness now is everywhere in therapy. You know, there's still controversy, but I think there's a lot more good options coming out with nutraceuticals. I think that there's other mind-body techniques and skills that they're getting such a strong scientific base that they really should not be considered alternative or complementary. They should become part of the regular treatment.
But still integrative.
Yeah. To me, integrative is a very different thing than complementary and alternative.
Yeah.
Very different. It's just blending into however you practice, in the things that seem to really work and make sense.
What about future direction? Where do you think we're heading?
You know, I think that in the very near future, you know, maybe within the next 5 years, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more happening through health coaches,
yeah,
and probably some other professions that we haven't maybe haven't thought of or haven't seen get established yet. But where it's not, where it's done, a lot of these things can be done as a team.
Yeah.
I think it's going to become much more collaborative.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be people that may have had their training in a specific area, but then they team up with other people that have been trained very differently,
yeah,
and create new models.
Yeah.
So I think that there's going to be a lot of room for innovation and creativity. It'll have to be science-based,
mm-hmm,
and it'll have to be based on good outcomes research, but we're going to see a lot of new things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it is going to be done by not by physicians, but maybe physicians as part of a team. And I think that the people are going to be trained in integrative ways of thinking and practicing right from the beginning,
yeah,
rather than having to go back and you know, get these things on their own like I did and probably like you did.
So that this way of seeing health and well-being as one continuum, not something that's compartmentalized.
Exactly.
The physical health being on the one side and the mental health being on the other side, but that the educational kind of paradigm will shift over time.
It will, yeah. Yep. And a lot of that is being driven by research that's already happening in neuroscience,
yeah,
and I think in nutrition and epigenetics and, you know, some of there's a really good and growing science base, but traditional medical model hasn't quite caught up with it yet.
Yeah.
But it is going to, and I think it's going to happen fairly soon.
Looking at an integrated mental health approach, and well, I guess we sometimes get a little bit caught up with the complementary alternative medicine side of it instead of looking at the whole picture. But how do you kind of address or think about some ethical concerns that might come up when it comes to evidence base of certain complementary alternative medicine modalities as compared to allopathic medicine or more traditional medicine that has a stronger evidence base for it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is a good question. My own view and my own practice is, I try to base everything that I possibly can on good science and good outcomes. But where those don't exist, and if there's something that I still think really has value or could really help a patient, I think it's perfectly within ethical reason to try to use those things as long as they're safe.
Yeah.
You know, I think safety is really and risk is the critical factor there. So, you know, I'm not suggesting really far out kinds of things, but,
right,
but you know, something that, you know, we maybe don't have a really, really strong science base that this has good outcomes, and yet there's no evidence of risk or bad side effects from it. I think that it's okay to try those things if you've got some experience and believe that it's been helpful to others. You know, if you were to base interventions strictly on outcomes research, we wouldn't be prescribing very many medications.
That's true.
At least certainly not to the degree that we do. And yet we do, because we need to offer something to patients who are suffering to this degree. And I think that, you know, it's also very reasonable and safer to offer some of these natural therapies and, you know, certainly mind-body skills where there's little to no risk. And so, you know, to me, I do not have an ethical problem with adding natural therapies that I know enough about to consider safe and really believe can be useful. You know, I think that where we have to be careful in terms of the ethics is promoting things that generate an income for
right.
us that
yes.
that maybe we don't have a good science, you know, backing or a really good experience. And I think that sometimes people can get a little bit tripped up in something that they've been trained to do. And so it's kind of their way of being able to work in this arena that maybe doesn't have that basis. And I think we have to be a little careful in that regard. But, you know, there are so many options out there that I think are really safe and often helpful. And, you know, even with psychotherapy, the thing that seems to be the most useful aspect to the patient is just having a good connection with the therapist.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of research on that that doesn't matter so much what type of therapy you're doing, as long as you have a really strong, trusting, open relationship with one another. And that can happen with people from a lot of different disciplines, where they really offer something that is healing for the patient because they have that ability to connect in a deeper way. I think that's really useful.
Well, I think that's an excellent way to end the session. Thank you so much for coming here and talking to me.
My pleasure.